Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network and on the RNW. We endeavor to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, supplying honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And you're invited to the conversation. If you want to join in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers right to the head of the line. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can also vote in our poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find the same question on our website at LarsLarson.com. And this is one I've been meaning to ask for a while. Are service and delivery people getting way too pushy when it comes to their tips? The delivery fee on a $6 to $20 pizza deal, and they're only getting, say, a $4 tip. You've run into this, I'm sure, as much as I have. You go in and you order a cup of coffee from one of the coffee stands. And there are some of them that I really like. Not as big a fan of Starbucks. I think they burn their beans. But when you get good service, people generally give a tip. And then came the era that only arrived a couple of years ago when they began to put a, well, it's a point of sale system on an iPad or a device like that. And they would turn the pad around and say, just asking, not mandatory. And they're actually asking for a tip. And what's always bothered me the most is that they're asking for the tip for good service before you've actually had any service. You put in your order. You have not received your order yet. And I'll tell you something. There have been times where I have put in an order for a hot cup of coffee, and I got a lukewarm cup of coffee, but by then, you'd already given the tip, which leaves a lot of us to believe if you're going to ask for the tip, you're not going to get it. Are the service and delivery people getting too pushy when it comes to tips, especially when if they are making the minimum wage in both Oregon and Washington, you're already making at full-time wages somewhere between $30,000 and $35,000 a year for pouring coffee into a cup. Now, is every single legal job in America a worthwhile job? I would say that it is. But if you're already getting $30,000 to $35,000 a year to pour coffee in a cup, and then you're asking the customer, would you mind giving me a tip before you've actually got the service? I suspect you're not going to get a tip in most cases. The poll on X today, are delivery and service people getting way too pushy when it comes to tips? Now, on Friday, on First Amendment Friday, we ask you this question. Should illegal aliens pay in-state tuition to go to college at taxpayer expense in places like Oregon and Washington? 95% of you join me in a no vote on that question. Only 5% of you voted yes. And if you might wonder, well, Lars, is this a proposal? No, it's already happening. In Oregon and Washington, if you're an illegal alien and you should be paying out-of-country tuition, in other words, if you're going to the University of Washington, maybe $44,000 a year. No, under state law, you pay only $13,000. You get the $31,000 discount that ordinarily would only go to somebody qualified for in-state tuition. Well, why do you get in-state tuition? Because those colleges and universities, at least the public ones, are paid for by the taxpayers and owned by the taxpayers of Washington State. So if your mom and dad are taxpayers in Washington State, you get a discount. If, on the other hand, your mom and dad are from Oklahoma or Nevada or Texas or Florida or some other place in America, you have to pay either out of state or, if you're from a foreign country, you get to pay out of country tuition. That is as much as $31,000 a year more. And then along come the illegal aliens. And what did the state lawmakers in Olympia and Salem decide? They decide, let's give in-state tuition to people who aren't even legally in the United States of America. Now, if somebody wants to defend that idea, that somehow you get in-state tuition, and it says that the kid who comes from Colorado or Oklahoma or Iowa or Vermont or New Hampshire, they're going to pay out-of-state tuition, but the illegal alien gets a benefit. Can you tell why people voted no on that? 95-5? In any case, let me get back to the teachers. Should some of America's highest paid teachers go on strike for more money? Well, the union representing Seattle teachers has voted to authorize a strike. And that puts the start of the school year, September 2nd, the day after tomorrow, in jeopardy. Now, when does the teacher's contract run out? It runs out today. The teacher's contracts expire today. Now, they've been negotiating for some time, but it turns out they weren't willing to negotiate in a way that actually got them to a deal. The vote at the Seattle Convention Center, which happened last week, overwhelmingly approved the strike with a 91% margin. Let me remind you of something. The union is demanding bigger wages. They are demanding smaller class sizes. And the district is saying, we can't do it. We are financially unable to pay that. Now, imagine this. You're producing a terrible result. In both Oregon and Washington, kids have terrible test scores when it comes to reading or math or other parts of learning. So the teachers are producing a terrible result. Now, I have heard all the arguments. It's not the teachers' fault. Well, I got to tell you something. Somehow, teachers for decades in this country have been able to teach kids. And in many cases, they had kids arrive who came from poor families, uneducated families, families where education, say, was not as prized as it is today. And yet somehow teachers were able to teach the kids. Except now, the union is asking for big wage increases above inflation. And the district says, we're only willing to give you about 2.5% a year. The union wants about double that much. And yet the Seattle Public Schools are looking at a big budget deficit, $87 million in the current upcoming school year, and a depleted rainy day reserve that went from $135 million a few years ago to about $30 million currently. So the cupboard is almost bare, and stats show the median salary for a Seattle Public School System teacher, $134,000 a year for a part-time job. And by the way, once the teachers negotiate a higher wage rate, it's going to affect the administrators as well. Most of them make $250,000, and they're going to end up making more money as well. And yet, the Seattle Public Schools, just like the Portland Public Schools, have been losing students. Seattle Public Schools has dropped almost 4,000 students in recent years. And why? Because parents finally realized our kids are not learning. So you're paying a boatload of money, your kids aren't learning, and now the teachers, some of the highest paid teachers in the United States of America, the Seattle, Washington teachers, are now demanding a big pay hike, or they're going to go on strike, and they're going to hurt your kids by telling you your kids are not going to start the school year the day after tomorrow. Now, what kind of lesson do you want to send to the teachers? Do you want to reward them for that kind of behavior and say, okay, if you're going to threaten us and if you're going to threaten our children, we'll bow to that extortion and we'll hand you more money? Is that really the lesson that you want those teachers to learn? Or do you want them to hear something entirely different? Back in a moment. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
We have a crash.
At the KXL News Desk with your Monday. Thinking about selling.
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, your body well right, you know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? Lars.
Pumped by River City Environmental. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey there, can anybody help me out and make sense of the antics of the Portland Public Schools? I know I just talked about Seattle Public Schools. They're just about as crazy. So let me start with a few data points. PPS student population has already shrunk considerably and is forecast to shrink even more in the years ahead, a full 2% just this year. Yet PPS is right in the middle of spending literally billions to build a bunch of new high schools twice as big as the student population needs and ranking as the most expensive high schools in America. At the same time as the big building push, PPS announces it plans to close up to 20 elementary schools. Now, a reminder, those are the very same schools that feed the population of future high school students. So, if you're going to close down 20 elementary schools, doesn't that suggest you're not even going to need those expensive high schools you're in the middle of building? And while PPS focuses on building unnecessary classrooms, are the kids actually learning much? Well, not a chance. Oregon's spending on K-12 education is some of the highest in America at almost $20,000 per student per year. That's $1,000 a year more than the national average per student per year. But on math and reading, Oregon students rank near the bottom of America, between 45th and 48th out of 50, 58 if you're an Obama voter. Do you think those students would fare better if parents and teachers paid more attention to learning and less to beautiful architecture in every single neighborhood? I'll get to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Why does the mayor of a major American city need hand-holding during an ordinary press conference? Well, Como News and Chris Daniels reports that Seattle Mayor Katie Wilson gave a press conference on traffic safety, and she managed to embarrass herself once again. During questioning, she had to have her assistant whisper the answers to her in full view of everyone. As if that wasn't bad enough, her assistant tried to tell the press that they could only ask about Mayor Wilson's traffic public safety plan and not the non-existent plan to combat gang violence, which is playing out in multiple neighborhoods around the city. This is very reminiscent of when another assistant to Mayor Wilson abruptly ended questioning by Como's Chris Daniels at a press conference earlier this year. We can only imagine this is going to get a lot worse. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Now, imagine this. Special treatment for so-called public servants, but taxpayer citizens are going to pay the regular rate. Consider this. The Portland City Council is voting this week on whether or not to issue all 9,000 city employees a TriMet fare card. Now, why would they give away a free fare card to all city employees? Well, it turns out the government in Oregon is going to close down the southbound lanes of Interstate 5 starting on September the 11th. And they're going to be closed not for a few days, but for 5 solid weeks. Now, during that time, is traffic going to become very chaotic and commuting becoming a giant nightmare? It's going to be a nightmare. So what does the city plan to do? The city, of course, is full of public servants who serve the public, except in this case, they're going to serve themselves. The city council is considering giving free bus passes to all city employees, but you citizens, yeah, you get the short end of the stick. Now imagine that. They're talking about spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy these free bus passes, all to accommodate the special needs of so-called public servants. In what kind of universe do the servants get paid, treated better than the people, the public, that they're actually expected to serve? It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Let me go first to Mark in Bellingham, listening on KGMI, which is part of our Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I was listening to you, and I heard about you talking about tips,
yeah.
And I cannot agree more with you. I mean, I had a situation a couple months ago. I'm bringing my son back from Wazoo. So we stopped in North Bend to get something to eat, and I think it was a taco time.
Yeah.
But we go up, go to the key, order off a kiosk, and then go sit down, and then some, I think they called our number, went up to the counter, got our food, and the worst part was they wanted a tip, and yet I did not make contact with a human the whole time. And they had the audacity to ask for a tip.
Isn't that crazy? Because they haven't actually done anything to serve you, have they?
Well, there was no service.
Yeah.
None. And I think the golden rule ought to be, if you have to walk up to a counter to get your food,
yep,
no tips. I'm a retired UPS driver.
Yep.
And you're talking about delivery. I mean, we never got tips. Never. And I think the reason was the general public knew kind of how much money we made.
And by the way, UPS drivers do make good money, and they have a good retirement program, don't they?
Yeah, they have an excellent retirement program. Yeah, I'm 55, and I'm retired.
Yeah, that's nice.
So, yeah, I mean, and it's just like, yeah, the only time we ever got anything was around Christmas for our customers. It was more of a thank you more than a tip.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think tipping is totally blown out of proportion.
I guess the other thing that bugs me about it, Mark, is, when you're a little kid, you get taught by your parents. You go to somebody's house and you say, hey, can I have a Coke? And your mom and dad say, you don't ask. Your host may offer, but you don't ask. And if you're a little kid and your birthday's coming up, you don't run around saying, it's cute, but you don't run around saying, hey, are you going to buy me a birthday present? Nor a Christmas present or any other kind of present. Well, if the tip is considered a gratuity, meaning a gift, then you don't ask for a gift. The minute you have to ask for the gift, then you're not asking for it. You're essentially saying, this is part of paying for the service, and I expect to get this gift, and you're going to give me the gift. I think the people who are running these businesses and the people working in them should understand that. Coming up in a moment, should political symbols have any place in middle school in front of your kids? We're going to talk about
the
that.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. On a Monday, kids at a Tigard Middle School are getting new planners, classroom planners tomorrow. But it's what's on the cover that has some parents asking whether politics like this belongs in the classroom. Welcome back to the program. If you want to join the conversation, we're certainly welcome. We're going to welcome you at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And join me in welcoming Ben Edel, who's an Oregon businessman, political activist, and the founder of Free Oregon. Ben, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be back, Lars.
I saw the post that you made on social media, and I want you to describe for my audience. It's a very simple symbol, I think, that is on the student planner at Tualatin Middle School in Tigard, Oregon. Tell my audience what it is they would see if they were a young student in that middle school and they got the planner that's being handed out tomorrow.
Yeah, well, tomorrow that planner is being handed out to every student. And on the front cover, it's very clean and simple. It's the Tualatin logo. It's a T-shaped logo, but it is converted into the LGBTQIA blah, blah, blah flag. And that's what they're going to see. And I posted about this on X last week, which I appreciate you you engaging with me on that, because when I see that symbol, I see it as a symbol of hate. I truly see it as a symbol of hate. I see it as whoever carries that flag hates me for my beliefs, hates me for my life and what I am. And I don't appreciate that. I think hate should have no business at all in a public school. I really get the same feeling when I see that symbol that I do when I see a swastika. And I know that sounds, over the top, but it's the honest truth. I see those symbols and I just shudder when I look at them. Like, oh, this is not okay.
No, I don't think it's okay either, but I wanted you to explain to my audience why you see of hate, because I see it as the same way. It's designed to divide people, and it's suggesting there's an us and there's a them. And if you don't get yourself on the us side of things, you're going to be on the them side. And you're doing this to kids who are, you know, a dozen years old, right?
That's right. They're 12 years old. And some of them are 11 when they're coming into sixth grade, and they're going to be coming into sixth grade at Tuolumne tomorrow. I'm actually a parent with two children in the Tiger Tuolumne School District, of which Tuolumne is a member. But yeah, I see this because I don't think there's anything wrong with living and let live. Live and let live is a huge part of our family's culture. We live and let live. We don't judge people. We don't do that stuff. But I believe in the United States, I believe that we are truly a cultural melting pot. And when you see symbols that represent, in my opinion, communism, because that's what it is, and the PTSD is controlled and run by, I believe, communists, and that's their symbol. That is not my symbol. I do not relate to that or identify to that. I identify to the American flag, and I believe that everybody can identify to the American flag. But here's the really important thing. This is about educating our kids. And if you look at what these DSA socialists and communists have done to the city of Portland economically, they're doing the same thing to our children from an educational standpoint. They're failing them miserably. And I think that our kids should be taught, number one, to live without judgment, let God do the judging, not us, and support each other and get a great education and learn the social skills that kids need to learn in middle school. Instead, they're being shown what I see as a Nazi symbol, a socialist symbol of hate that is on the cover, and not only on the cover, but probably in a lot more areas across the school.
Well, and I kind of wonder, I mean, look, Ben, you've been involved in politics before. You've been involved in schools. I'm kind of curious. I'd love to talk to some of the school board members in that district about this and say, why would you allow a divisive symbol like this, knowing that there will be parents and kids who identify with it, but there will also be maybe an even greater number of parents and kids who don't identify with it, and you're deliberately pushing them to the outside. You're marginalizing them. Are you not?
They are. That's exactly what they're doing. And you know what's crazy to me? I don't feel like there's anything we can do about this until we have truly secure elections. Because, look, I get this information not just from kids. I get this from staff in the PTSD. There are a lot of teachers who are absolutely against this. Some of them, many of them, are Democrats. They want to just teach kids. We have great teachers in the PTSD. This isn't a teacher's thing. This is an administrative thing. This is the state of Oregon thing. And I feel like until we can get secure elections, there's not a lot we can do about this democratically, because nobody likes this stuff. Nobody wants males in girls' locker rooms and in girls' sports. Nobody wants to see these marginalizing symbols being indoctrinated into our children's brains every day. This is not something that that is acceptable by, I believe, the majority of people in the district.
And yet, let me ask you a question, just to cut to the chase. I'm talking to Ben Edel, who's an Oregon businessman, political activist, and the founder of Free Oregon. What are those why don't those teachers speak up? And is it because they know that if they spoke up and said, this is the wrong kind of symbol to put in front of kids, that they would pay a deep penalty for it?
100% they will. They sneak this stuff to me. They send it to me. They want me to put it out there. They want to expose it. They want to stop it. And they face they definitely face retribution and retaliation, not only from administration, but from also fellow teachers, because there are teachers in the district that are absolutely militant when it comes to this socialist communist symbolism that is divisive and anti-American.
I guess, and that's the concern I've got, is you've got schools that aren't performing well at all. And I started today by talking about how Portland Public Schools are building these $500 million high schools at the same time that they're saying the district is shrinking so fast they may have to close 20 elementary schools. And in Seattle, They've got teachers paid some of the best paychecks in America, $134,000 a year for a part-time job, a three-quarter-time job, and they're demanding more, even though the results they produce with the schools are absolutely, they stink. They absolutely stink, and yet they're saying, pay us more money.
Yeah, worst in the country. It's absolutely horrific. We got the highest taxes, the worst education, the worst economy, the fastest slowing economy. I mean, they're destroying our civilization across the state, and the education system is 100%, central to that strategy. When you see what they're doing, it's strategic. They've taken over our schools. We have to get them back. We have to take the schools back, and it's really incredible.
Ben, before we run out of time, tell people how to find Free Oregon.
Oh, you can go to the best thing to do is to go to you can go to ruckpassrucac.org and go to freeoregon.us.
Very good. Hey, Ben Edel, thank you very much. We appreciate your time. Coming up in a moment, Portland has been the punchline of plenty of jokes like Portlandia, and now one local filmmaker is turning that reputation into a movie called Hassan Hates Portland. So what exactly... Here, if you're losing...
You're surrounded by Northwest liberals.
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails. The Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So Portland has been the punchline of lots and lots of jokes. I mean, long before Portlandia and ever since. But now we've got one, a brand new feature that's called Hassan Hates Portland. And the one who created it is Misha Webley, who joins me now, a longtime filmmaker and the director of the upcoming film Hassan Hates Portland. Welcome to the program, Misha.
Hey, good to be here, Lars.
You've been shooting films since, I mean, just to give people an idea, a context for it, you started shooting on Super 8 film, so that people can tell
right.
Us a long time ago.
You're dating me a little bit, that's right.
Well, I mean, my dad used to shoot films on regular 8, so that gives you an idea of how old I am. But tell me about that and what brought you created Jumptown Films. We'll get to Hassan Hates Portland, because when I started to see the social media posts, I was saying, this looks really interesting, but tell my audience what Jumptown Films has been all about.
Yeah, well, I've been making films since I was 17. So when I made that first Super 8 film, born and raised in Portland, and I just got the bug from my dad, and started teaching myself how to do it. You know, read a lot of books at Powell's, got myself into a class that could get my hands on a camera, and went from there. And since then, I've worked all around, in Portland, L.A., New York. But almost all the films I've done, this will be my second feature film, done multiple shorts, and then the web series Hassan Hates Portland. Almost all of them have been based in Portland. I've always wanted to, it's a beautiful place, but I've always wanted to kind of show a different side of the city and just kind of my own perspective on it. And it's a great place to shoot films. Jumptown, actually, I take it from a nickname, from the area in northeast Portland that I grew up in, that used to be called, and really try to focus on that and sort of, telling a different story about our city. But also just finding a lot of different, characters, ways to evoke that, that we don't see too often.
Well, in fact, I'm talking to Misha Webley, who's a Portland filmmaker. Jumptown Films is the name of his company. Hassan Hates Portland is his latest feature that's at the front of the list. But you said it's a great place to shoot. Hasn't Oregon stood in for just about every state at one time or another in various feature films and movies?
It has. And I think that's one of the, for me as a native Portland, I sort of want to correct the record, put our own version of the place, out there. Yes, it has, it's stood in. And then it's also, of course, there was Portlandia, which is its own, version of the city. You could call this an alternate to that.
All right, Misha, tell me about this. Tell me about Hassan Hates Portland. You start out with a character who's kind of a depressed single dad and go from there.
Yeah, well, the movie we're working on, we're starting production this Saturday, so very, very soon. But it's based off a web series that came out in 2024. And, you know, the movie picks up where it left off. The series was really, you know, a kind of a dark comedy satire on Portland, seen through, you know, a place like Portland, seen through a black perspective, or one black man's perspective. That would be Hassan, a good friend of mine, Hassan Thomas. But obviously fictional and somewhat absurdist satire on sort of the Portland culture and kind of the absurdities and hypocrisies, if you will, that we experience and lots of people experience. And we had a lot of fun with it. The series did really well. People really, it really struck a chord. You know, the episodes were maybe 3 to 4 minutes a piece. And I built a story, a world, from there. I really wanted to, from the beginning, wanted to build out this world of Portland from that perspective, from that same sort of pretty sharp satire of Portland culture, and really wanted to just kind of, you know, I want to make fun of Portland, but in my own way, and in a way I wanted, you know, Portlandia to go further, and this is me taking it a little further. I think there's, you know, maybe a little bit of a critical eye to it, but, you know, all with love because it is my hometown, but there's a lot that needs to be, you know, let's say highlighted about
well, or skewered, because you point out it's one of America's whitest and weirdest cities. So how does that play
exactly
into the story?
Yeah, well, you know, I think kind of an underexplored perspective is, you know, what's it like to be black in a place like that that's very white but also very progressive, and you know, you wouldn't know it from reading some of, you know, stuff online or how it's talked about, but that perspective is not really seen very much. A lot of times it's actually kind of, you know, it's spoken for us. But, you know, from the outside, you know, from that perspective, you see a lot of really absurd behavior. You see a lot of, you know, there's a good amount of hypocrisy in there. There's a lot that we really want to, you know, make fun of, but we also want the place to be better.
But how much of it is virtue signaling, do you think?
A lot of it. You know, and I think that's a big part of it, you know, right, is that the virtue signals don't match up to reality. So there's a lot of bumper stickers, there's a lot of signs saying what people support, but in, you know, my experience, a lot of my friends, you know, black, brown, and other, the interactions and experiences we have very commonly with a lot of those same people are pretty much the opposite of what the virtue signaling bumper stickers might say. Needs to be pointed out. And I think it needs to be, satirized. Because, you know, virtue signals don't make change. And they don't serve anybody except for the person making the signal. And we shouldn't conflate those things, you know, what someone says they believe and how they actually act. And I think that I'd like to see a lot less of that and a lot more of, you know, genuine action and genuine interactions with people.
I'm talking to Portland filmmaker Misha Webley. So you start shooting this Saturday. Now, with a multi-million-dollar production like yours, how long is shooting going to go on?
let's divide that by a lot, those multi-millions. We are shooting for 16 days total throughout September and a little bit of October. You know, we are a small homegrown production. It's relatively low budget, feature length, but we've gotten some support from different places. We're actively running a Kickstarter campaign to kind of top off our budget. That's live for as we speak. You can find that on Kickstarter under Hassan Hates Portland or any of our social media. You know, a lot of the show and the movie has been, it's really come from community support, whether that's, you know, financial or really just a lot of people helping out, working on the film.
That's the way to get it done. That's Misha Webley, the head of Jumptown Films, and most recently, Hassan Hates Portland. Misha, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for the big show? In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This. is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network endeavoring to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and provide honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest states. Our poll on X today. Are delivery and service people getting just a bit too pushy when it comes to tips? Saying, would you like to leave a tip? Not mandatory, of course, but it's your choice. Yes, I know it's my choice. And simply putting in an order for coffee or food does not justify a tip. But you can find today's X poll at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by eLegacy. You've spent your whole life building up your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set your kids or grandkids up for success by creating a customized estate plan with eLegacy.com. Just go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. I want to talk about a plan by Oregon government that may tack an extra $8,000 cost onto every single new home in Oregon. Now, this is from the same governor and the same government run by Democrats who say housing is too expensive, so let's add some extra costs. And the perfect guy to talk about is Justin Wood, who's the owner of Fish Construction Northwest. Justin, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Lars.
So tell my audience what these new heat pump mandates amount to and why they should be concerned about this.
Well, so kind of what the heat pump mandate is, just getting a little bit of back history on this, is Governor Brown actually put a executive order in back when she was governor that required Oregon to get to net zero on all building new construction. And in order to get to net zero on all building new construction, they really have to kind of get push us away from using natural gas in new homes. And so what the Oregon Building Codes Division and the Governor Kochak are really doing is still trying to follow Governor Brown's executive order and try to push us to net zero. What they're doing is a little bit different tact on this. There have been some states that have outright tried to ban the use of natural gas in new construction homes. What they're doing is basically requiring electric heat pumps in new construction homes, which would effectively make it very difficult, if not the cost prohibitive, to put natural gas into your new home. So it's kind of an end around way of stopping us from using natural gas in homes, which has a host of other impacts, but also adds quite a lot of cost to the affordability of new construction.
Well, I would also call it sneaky, Justin, because they, you know, Governor Brown did not go to the legislature and say to the people's representatives, pass this ban natural gas. She didn't do that. She said, instead, let's sign an executive order that requires heat pumps. And then, as you said, after putting in a requirement for heat pumps, trying to add natural gas on top would be cost prohibitive. So effectively, she got a ban on natural gas without asking the people's representatives, right?
Yeah, that's essentially what she did. And to be clear, the ban on the heat pumps is not, this is just kind of the next step in the process, because this has been now going on for 5 or 6 years. And so by requiring us to do the heat pumps, I don't think she outright said, let's just make everybody use heat pumps. But she said, let's, you know, make this push towards getting rid of natural gas. And because of the directive that she gave with that overarching directive, this is kind of the result of what the Building Codes Division has to do in order to meet her directive, barring some change from Governor Kochak or the legislature, which some neighboring states like California, which California is generally considered has some of the craziest, strictest building codes. But even California looked at their building code and what they were doing and said, look, housing costs are too expensive. We're going to pause on doing anything new related to building codes and stuff for 6 years because we need more housing and we need more housing affordability. So let's just hit pause on anything like that would add to housing costs. Unfortunately, Oregon is not doing that, and they're still following through with Governor Brown's executive order and pushing forward.
Okay, and when it comes to using natural gas or heat pumps, is there any real practical reason not to like it, except for the environmentalists saying we don't like anything that burns fossil fuels?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, I build mostly entry-level kind of starter, what they're calling middle housing, you know, smaller townhome type things and projects. And for me, the biggest issue is water heaters. Tankless gas water heaters are the best thing on the market from an efficiency standpoint and a space standpoint. They don't take up a lot of room, and they provide endless hot water at a very efficient rate, and they can take up a really small amount of space in a relatively small unit, which is what we're trying to build more and more of. And so a tankless gas hot water heater is a great option for that, which is essentially being pushed out of that by not being able to use natural gas. It also takes away the ability for people who want to have a choice about their cooking surface, because a lot of people prefer a gas cooktop over an electric cooktop. And then really, if you put an electric heat pump in, you're not using a gas furnace. Fortunately for furnaces, there are good options either way. A heat pump and a furnace do work. The challenge with an electric heat pump, at least, is that it only really kind of works well in about a 40 degree delta from your comfort temperature of 70 degrees. So if we really get really cold weather and we get down in the 20s, you know, your heat pump isn't going to give you the same heat that a gas furnace is going to give you. So there's some drawbacks, and we've seen plenty of issues with resiliency in our grid, where we've had, you know, ice storms, power generation going down, and various issues like that. And so in a perfect world, the way we'd like to build these houses is with what hybrid systems, where you provide electric and gas options so that people can have the best of both worlds and have that choice to have the best system in their home. And that's something that works when the electricity is out or the gas is, you know, gas is up in price and you want to use your electric heat pump but to have that option. But unfortunately, kind of the way we're being steered for this is to take away that option from home buyers and not give them an option.
And by the way, Justin, I'm one of the biggest fans out there of the on-demand, you know, hot water heaters that run on gas, because I've been using them for more than 20 years. And I do a lot of business with a plumbing company, so I could have whatever kind I want. But when I see these ridiculous hybrid ones that look like they take up twice as much space and they cost a lot of money and they don't work as fast as an on-demand. And the idea of the on-demand is that natural gas doesn't get turned into heat until the moment it's hitting your water and heating it, whereas electricity has to be sent from somewhere, and there are losses. So there are a lot of reasons, I think, to favor the on-demand gas, and yet they've been effectively outlawed by folks like Kate Brown and Tina Kotek.
Yeah, definitely, and it's unfortunate because it's just, you know, you mentioned those, the hybrid water heaters, the electric one. They're not on demand, so you're basically paying electricity to keep your tank of water hot all the time. But yeah, they also, like you said, take up twice as much space. And when I'm building a 1,000-square-foot two-bedroom townhome with one coat closet and a small closet for each bedroom, and that's it, we have to essentially take one of those away just to stick a giant heat pump water heater in there, which has to be vented to the outside, has to draw fresh air. And it's just unfortunate for the small kind of construction that, you know, we are trying, that Governor Kotek and the city of Portland are really trying to encourage more of this middle housing construction that promotes kind of trying to get us to build more units, more density. And unfortunately,
but it's hard to get it done when you're trying to put all these extra rules on top. That's Justin Wood, the owner of Fish Construction NW. Justin, thanks very much. Look your best, and guys.
Oh, taxes. What say you, Robin Hood?
So you think you're overtaxed?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope.
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got to tell you about the Democrat Socialist of America. This is the new wing of America's Democrat Party, the party of slavery since 1829, and still the party of slavery today. But now the DSA is saying, we're going to come out and we're going to deliver so much. We're going to give you a much bigger government, but somebody else is going to pay the tab. So the question is, If the Democrat socialist agenda is going to promise to make your life a whole lot more expensive without ever taking a penny from America's richest people who aren't even going to come close to covering the bill, wait until you hear the price tag. Let me get this to you in a moment. First, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So, as the New York Post sums it up, the Democrat Socialists of America are pushing for a federal government spending spree on everything from race reparations to the Green New Deal. Now, the total cost of all of that is estimated, just a thumbnail sketch of it, $200 trillion. Now, to put that in context, $200 trillion over the next decade is spending $20 trillion a year for 10 years in a row. And if you say, well, how much is $20 trillion? Well, $20 trillion is almost exactly three times the current size of the United States federal government. And $20 trillion is a good chunk of the entire GDP of the United States of America. So can we afford to have a $200 trillion spending spree and spend it on all these things? Reparations, the Green New Deal. Let me give you a list of some of these, and I'll give you some idea of what's going on. And then if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. The proposals from the DSA would result in government spending surging to 57% of the gross domestic product. Now, what does that mean? That means that if you add up the value of all the goods and all the services produced by America's economy, the biggest and best economy on planet Earth, government would consume 57% of it. Now, remember, most of what that GDP has to go for is housing Americans, feeding Americans, providing energy for Americans. It has to go to all the goods and services that actually supply our needs. What happens when the federal government starts to consume 57% of the GDP? Now, that is a lower bounds estimate from the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute. It could be a lot worse, but that is the low ball estimate of what it's going to cost. In 2025, the U.S. government spent approximately 34% of America's gross domestic product. The DSA is selling people a bigger government and saying somebody else will pay for it, but it's mathematically impossible. That's the conclusion of Adam Michel. Adam Michel is the author of a report that just came out about the DSA. The biggest items the DSA plans to pursue, universal health care. Now, that by itself is going to cost between $39.9 trillion and $75 trillion over the next decade. In other words, to put it back in context, the cost of universal health care for America, which the DSA is promising, works out to about the same amount per year that the entire federal budget costs today. So that gives you an idea of what they're talking about. Slavery, reparations, $13.5 trillion to $28 trillion over the next 10 years. In other words, as much every year as half the size of the entire federal government. And a federal jobs guarantee, $4.4 trillion to as much as $60 trillion. At the very high end, government spending would reach an eye-popping 92% of the GDP. Now, if you took the combined net worth of the 400 richest Americans, that got to $6.6 trillion in 2025. And if you took every single penny of the 400 richest Americans, it would equal about 1 year of this new DSA agenda. In any case, let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, it's funny. You made a comment about allegedly reparations for the slavery from the 1800s forward. And I'm just curious how we're going to call that reparations, because the Democrat Party was the Ku Klux Klan still. Why would the American people being victimized by the Democrats' Klan be paying reparations for Democrats' Klan? I don't understand that.
We wouldn't be. And by the way, do you know what? You've only touched the surface of it, Ron. Because if you really dig down into it and you say, well, what about the slaves that were white slaves that were held, not nearly as many as black slaves in America, are they entitled to reparations? What about black slave holders who owned slaves? I mean, Kamala Harris, you remember that Kamala Harris's, I think it was her granddad, had talked about owning slaves in Jamaica. Does that mean that Kamala Harris's family would have to pay for their role that they played in slavery, or would her skin color excuse her from having to pay part of that bill? It gets very, very thorny. And what would you do to compensate the descendants of white people who are held as slaves?
I'm quite okay with reparations being paid, but it needs to come out of the DNC.
Yeah, I'm not in favor of them being paid at all. And I'll tell you why. Because nobody alive today was held as a slave. Nobody alive today. And if you say, well, but my particular group, you know, demographic group, racial group, or otherwise, was at a disadvantage. There were lots and lots of groups in the United States that were at a disadvantage at one time or another. Asians who emigrated to the United States legally or illegally were at a disadvantage. Irish were often at a disadvantage. And to a greater or lesser extent than black Americans were Hispanic Americans. Could you make the argument that people who came as illegal aliens and worked as illegal aliens, that somehow they were at a competitive disadvantage over the various decades, and that their families would have been much better off? You could make a reparations argument for all those different groups. But then you've got the question of, even if you decide that reparations are owed, who in the world has the money to pay any of this? As we just pointed out, the math suggests that even if you went out and took away every dime that Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and all the richest people in America had, it wouldn't pay for a year of what the DSA has in mind. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and dropping a Portland truth bomb.
My favorite thing about living in Portland is no matter how many fentanyl overdoses happen, no matter how many tents get set up, you can't blame black people for that.
Back to Lars.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, Friday night, very late on Friday night, certainly too late to include in my talk show, Donald Trump announced a deal that would give the United States a stake in Venezuela's vast oil reserves. He says it's a step toward his goal of extracting energy from the country after American forces captured then-President Nicolas Maduro in a middle-of-the-night raid way back in January. Doesn't seem like it's been that long, but in any case, it has been. I thought we'd talk about it with Matt Cody, who is president of the Oil and Gas Workers Association. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be on with you today.
Hey, give my audience the short, because I'm not in the oil business. I don't have any expertise there, and most of them don't either, I would imagine. So does this have the potential to bring energy costs down dramatically for Americans at some point?
Yes, the answer is yes. President Trump is absolutely right whenever he says that it will lower gas prices for all Americans for years to come.
So what does it take to make this happen, though, and what's it going to cost us up front? And I would imagine if we're dealing with a country like Venezuela, is there some risk that maybe the country renationalizes its assets and simply steals back what's come to us?
There's always that risk. And in fact, there's that risk in almost every foreign nation. If you look at what the country of Chad did whenever they nationalized ExxonMobil's assets, I believe in 2023, we certainly have that risk in an unstable political environment in Venezuela. But with the U.S., with our influence in South America, and of course, with great trade relationships, we're able to minimize a lot of that.
Well, in fact, this deal says the U.S. has 55% effective output of the new private company that's going to do the deal with Venezuela. So it sounds like if it works the right way, It will benefit American consumers. It'll benefit that private company. It'll benefit the American taxpayer. And ultimately, it'll benefit the people of Venezuela. Rosie, a view?
No, you're seeing it perfectly right, because that's what it does. Look, our Gulf Coast refineries especially are set up to process a heavier crude than what we produce here in the United States. And so
that's that West Texas intermediate stuff, and we need something.
That's exactly right.
What's the other one? The Brent crude, right?
No, so Brent is kind of the benchmark, the global standard. Whenever we talk about a heavier crude, which is what we produce most of in the South America anyway, when we talk about the Mexican Mayan crude, or whenever we talk about Venezuela, most of that comes from the Orinoco Belt. So it's a heavier crude, just different API, different gravity. And so it comes out a little bit thicker. There's a different refining process for it. So it's just different than the lighter, sweeter crude oil that we produce here, which you accurately said, West Texas Intermediate. That's the benchmark that we use here in the U.S. And so the refineries are set up to process that heavier crude. We need to continue importing heavier crude because that's what lower gas prices. Look, we would love to just have everything set up where everything was just American oil, but we would wind up in a policy of isolationism, and it would cost billions of dollars to upgrade those refineries.
Well,
and then,
but let me ask you something, Matt, because one of the frustrations I've got is people say, well, why don't the oil companies build some more refineries? I said, would you build a refinery if Joe Biden just a couple of years ago was telling you, we're going to put you all out of business in a decade? No, of course not. So, but at this point, if you could guarantee a supply of both U.S. oil, the lighter, sweeter stuff, and the thicker stuff from Venezuela, could we get some of the oil companies to upgrade their existing facilities or even build a new one? There is one under construction, isn't there?
Yes, there's one, of course, South Texas, and then there's some others that have announced that they're putting in new refineries. I saw one this last week. It's going to be down around San Antonio, Texas, and that will process the lighter, sweeter crude oil. Also, while I can't, you know, publicly tell you about anything right now, we can do both things, and President Trump and this White House, his energy advisors, and a lot of his staff, we've been working with them for months. And, of course, with my friend Governor Jeff Landry from Louisiana, Governor Patrick Morrissey from West Virginia, you know, governors all across the state, state reps, you know, energy companies. There's a whole much bigger plan. I don't know, that probably wasn't the right way to say that, but there's a much bigger plan where we can do both.
And in fact, there's almost no other way for Venezuela to do it, is it? Because Maduro ran down the infrastructure so much, you say, well, they've got lots of oil. Yes, but you have to have the equipment to get it out of the ground and get it to where it needs to go. And that's going to cost a lot of money. And you have to persuade people to spend that kind of money or invest it in a place where they worry that they'll invest the money and then they'll have it stolen from them at some point. What's the way to allay that fear?
Manlars, you're absolutely right. Being able to bring stability to that region of South America is so crucial. And so being able to establish those trade relationships. Look, if you go back to the 2018 Brookings Institute study that tied crime rates to poverty levels, well, then the longer the people of Venezuela stay poor, the more the crime is, the more those cartels, you know, those militias, those factions take root and grow. But being able to be good trading partners with the people of Venezuela, that brings prosperity to them, and that benefits both them and us here in the United States. So it's a win-win all around.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, it really, like Ronald Reagan said, the best social program in the world is a job. So rather than having to, you know, pony up a bunch of foreign aid and give it away to countries like Venezuela, why don't we just make it possible for the people of that country to earn their own living and benefit us at the same time?
Absolutely right. And while we're talking about past presidents, I find it funny that in present day, some of the people who are opposing President Trump's great deal in Venezuela, well, in 2022, whenever Joe Biden's administration granted a license to Chevron to continue production and to export that oil to the United States, well, those people were fully on board whenever it was Joe Biden's plan. That's the thing we need to do. And that's one of the things that President Trump does so well, is to bring Americans together and say, hey, look, regardless of party, this is good for our country. This is good for everybody here.
Well, Matt Cody, president of the Oil and Gas Workers Association. Matt, you got to remember about those Democrats, the ones who backed up President Otto Penn and the deal to keep stuff coming to the United States from Venezuela. If they didn't have double standards, Matt, they wouldn't have any standards at all, would they?
Oh, man, Lars, we could go on all day about the hypocrisy in politics.
I just want to see this stuff. And I understand nobody's, well, when is it going to lower my gas prices? Next week. I mean, what do you think? I mean, stuff like this is going to take some time to move the needle. But if you could take the higher prices for a short period of time and know that it's going to lead to longer prices that are going to be very, very stable and hold things in place, I'll tell you what, I think most Americans understand if it's a matter of paying a little bit now to save a whole bunch of money over the long term, that's why people buy houses. That's Matt Cody, president of the Oil and Gas Workers Association. Matt, it's a pleasure. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show. Her shoulders hurt.
Have something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. My email of the day, but you can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Joy writes in, Lars, so there are two segments you had on the transgender issue on Friday. I don't know why you gave me a hard time when I called in. And by the way, as of today, transgender women cannot compete in college sports or in the Olympics. That's right. That's a good start. So why do you have this obsession about covering these issues around the transgender community over and over again? I just don't understand. Let me explain it to you simply, Joy. Anything that involves the mutilation with knives or drugs of teenage children, boys or girls, is evil and it needs to be stopped. And if you expect me to say, well, we've solved part of the college sports problem or the Olympic sports problem, so now we don't have to worry about parts being cut off teenage boys and girls in America or them being given sterilizing drugs and hormones in America. No, I'm going to continue to be concerned about those kinds of issues. In any case, send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Let me go first to Becky, who's a naysayer. Hey, Becky, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today that makes you a naysayer?
Okay, concerning the wildfires, and of course this has been such a bad year for them, and you have said that a lot of the cause of it is poor forest management, that we need to do more logging.
Yeah.
Okay, I live east of the Cascades. There aren't many trees out here. And we have had the wildfires in recent years, and I've seen them increasing, it seems, more every year.
Wildfires that burn grass primarily, right, Becky? Becky?
From grass.
Becky, because you didn't want to start by saying what it is you disagree about, if you're saying you live in a place that's mostly grass and brush rather than trees, in that case, and we've addressed that as well, because this year they're merging both the numbers of acres of wildfires in trees and wildfires in grasses. You'd agree that when all that grass catches fire and it fills the air with smoke, that's a problem. And I would argue that it's largely a land management problem where the folks in charge of managing that land, mostly the U.S. Forest Service, the BLM, and to some extent state forest agencies, have done a bad job of managing that land. Right?
So you're not just saying that it's that more trees need to be cut?
Because more trees do need to be cut.
There aren't many trees.
No, but Becky, you said that already. I understand that if you're in a place where there aren't any trees, we're not talking about forest fires because it takes trees to make a forest. But if you're in a place where grass is catching fire and it's causing problems, and it is, because those grass fires, they burn people's houses, they burn power poles, they burn infrastructure, they put lives at risk. People end up dying in fires, whether they're in the forests or in the grass or a mix of the two. Would you agree that there's a problem if we need to manage that land differently, the way private companies manage their land, and say if we have fires, we put them out promptly because otherwise our assets burn? Does that make sense?
Okay, but you're not saying that the problem is in cutting more trees.
It is a problem.
In
no,
my
I
area,
am,
there
no,
aren't
no,
many
Becky,
to cut.
Becky, no, I'm not saying that. Because in the places where there are forests that catch fire, we need to do more logging and more active management of those forests. In the places where it's grass, we need to do more active management of the grasslands. So if you're saying, Lars, are you saying that in places where there are no trees, we need to cut more trees? Becky, I'll help you out with that because it seems like a question that answers itself. Of course, I'm not saying cut more trees if there aren't more trees. But if you want to just talk about the problem in general, it's active land management, whether it's management of trees, management of grasslands, or, as is the case in much of eastern Oregon, western Oregon, it is a management of lands that include both, and you have to manage them.
Okay, and I have seen the fires increase. I have been evacuated myself three times in about the last 10 years. I've been evacuated.
Yep. And you know why that's happening?
I remember years ago we did not have fires like
that. And you are right about that. And what do you think changed?
I don't know, but
I can't. Okay, Becky, then you don't listen to the show very
much.
Becky, do you not listen to the show very much? Because I will tell you this. Over the last 30 years, we've talked about Dr. Bob Zybak dozens of times. And he pointed out that between the mid-50s and the mid-80s, we had a period of time with no big fires at all. One fire north of 10,000 acres. Today, that's a nothing fire. Now we're in a...
Why are they increasing to east of the Cascades?
They're increasing all over the entire region because of bad land management. Because it
was
used
that
to be
the case? Were the grassy lands managed differently years ago?
Yes. Yes. And you know what you could do that would make a big difference right away, Becky? Number one, increase grazing on federal lands. Do you know what the environmental groups do, the so-called tree huggers? Every time you talk about increasing grazing, where the animals eat the fuel down and you have less chance of fire, and when you do have a fire, it's not as vigorous a fire because you don't have much fuel for that fire because the animals have eaten.
One of the bad fires this year was in southeast Oregon, where, as I understand, it was rangeland that burned thousands of acres.
But it wasn't being grazed. That's part of the problem is the environmental groups will go out. Every time there's a proposal for increased grazing, the environmental groups go to court, and they tell a judge, stop this, shut this down, don't let them graze that land. And they do the same thing when you talk about logging. So when they have forests that are set up as... they're ready to catch fire. And Becky, one of the worst places in the Northwest is we'll have a fire and the environmental groups go to court and say, don't salvage log those trees. Becky, what kind of firewood do you suppose those standing trees make 2 or 3 years after they burned in a fire, but there's still a lot of wood in them? That's pretty, it's like having a stack of tinder sitting out there ready to catch fire again, whether it's human caused or lightning caused. When those trees catch fire that burned 2 or 3 years ago, but they're still standing trees, you're going to have a gigantic fire because the environmental groups say, we are not going to let you clean up the fuel. It must sit there and dry out. And when it catches fire, it'll go off like a bomb. But Becky, I appreciate a good naysayer. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
Please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This
is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to tell you about something that's happening, and very rarely do we get a chance in advance to talk about something that's developing tonight that is likely to be a major story tomorrow. And that is the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, is speaking to a major Republican Jewish gathering that's going on tonight in Las Vegas. But reporters not only have not been invited, reporters have now been banned from attending this event with Vice President J.D. Vance. And one of those journalists is our friend Ari Hoffman, who holds down the great talk show on our Seattle affiliate, and that's KVI, the Ari Hoffman Show. Ari, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
Pleasure to be here, Lars. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're in Las Vegas, and you are covering this event, and you had anticipated going to an event tonight with the vice president speaking. What happened?
So this is usually a big event, and it's over 1,000 people are here from the Jewish community, from Israel, from all these places, and usually lots of politicians make appearances. And we had tons of congressmen last night, and we had tons of people from the administration today. But the vice president was supposed to be the keynote speaker tonight, and he's scheduled to speak. But then we started getting these press advisories that we weren't allowed to be in the room during his speech. And we weren't allowed to ask him questions. We couldn't do interviews with him. Now, Lars, you know that you have people you reach out to the administration, and yep. they say, yeah, the person's available, no, the person's not. I've never gotten a flat-out no like this before. And it turns out it wasn't just me. It was everybody. And the crazy thing is, yeah. now they're doing a Secret Service sweep of the entire floor. So they shut down the media row even earlier. So now we can't even do our other interviews in addition to that.
So what do you think is going on? And I want to know whether or not you think it might be related to some comments that J.D. Vance made recently. He was talking to Joe Rogan, and people know Joe Rogan, and he said there are some people in the Israeli government who we know beyond a shadow of a doubt are manipulating and trying to change American public opinion to keep the war in Iran going on indefinitely. And what I would say to Americans who sort of see this and are frustrated by my attitude, this is J.D. Vance, is you should be frustrated at American leaders who are persuaded by this or affected by this. Now, whether you agree with that notion or not, is that what J.D. Vance is trying to repair or change or in some way amend because he made those comments and he got a lot of blowback about it?
I think he's coming here to repair those comments, but the problem is, if you're going to repair those comments and the media wants to ask you the questions and the press gaggles afterwards, hey, you said this before, has your feelings changed? Why has your feelings changed? I actually think it's a little bit different, Lars. In the front of the room, on the main stage, is the Jewish Republican Coalition logo. And that logo has a giant Jewish star in it. And my theory is what happens is if the Tucker Carlson types of the world who support J.D. Vance see him standing in front of that, that's going to be a no-go for them.
So you're thinking that what he's trying to do is somehow camouflage that by banning reporters from the room as though if there are no reporters, if Ari Hoffman's not in there and no other journalists are there to cover J.D. Vance coming and speaking to this group, that somehow it's going to keep it a secret from people like Tucker Carlson?
Yeah, because I'm sure nobody in that room is going to tape the thing, even though I've got people willing to do it already. So I think that what he's trying to do is minimize the damage to that side of things. Or there's another alternative here. It's that, look, he gets clipped and he gets taken out of context from time to time. And maybe they just want to release the video in its entirety before it gets torn apart so they can say, whatever you're clipping of this guy, here's his entire speech. Last night, from the Republican Jewish Coalition, they released all the videos after everybody had spoken in their entirety on YouTube. Then they put up the clips on social media. So perhaps they're trying to avoid that, but I've never had it where a press pool from the White House said they couldn't attend an event like they did tonight, and then telling all the reporters they couldn't attend an event. It may be one thing to say, hey, the story's embargoed for a few hours, but this is unprecedented as long as I've been doing this stuff.
Well, and Ari, tell me this, just so people understand. Ordinarily, when the president travels, he's got a bunch of press that follow along. When the vice president travels, he's got a bunch of press. Secretary of State, kind of the same deal, to a greater or lesser degree. In this case, the usual gaggle that would follow along and cover what J.D. Vance is saying while he's on the road, they're not included in this trip?
Where do you want to go? The chair's right there? Yeah, exactly right. They're not going at all. Lars, I have to jump off the phone right now.
I totally
Thanks
understand.
Thanks for having me, buddy. Appreciate it.
No, I okay. totally understand, and I appreciate you coming on. That's Ari Hoffman. Ari holds down his talk show, which is on our Seattle affiliate, which is KVI in Seattle. But imagine this. You're going to have the Vice President of the United States. He's going to travel all the way to Las Vegas. He's going to talk to an influential group. And then you tell the White House press corps, and you're not going to cover it. Oh, and by the way, the reporters that are there at the event, you're not going to cover it either. Now, what's going on, and what is it that J.D. Vance is trying to hide? Or is the White House trying to hide something? None of that makes any sense. In any case, glad to have you with me. If you want to join the conversation, let's go to Tom. Tom, you think you've got an explanation as to why socialism is so popular all of a sudden? Welcome to the program. What do you think?
Thank you, Lars. I could make a quick comment on why Vance is doing what he's doing before I go on to socialism.
Do it quickly, and please.
Okay, the reason why he's doing that is he's trying to create some distance between him and Trump. So when Trump gets impeached after the midterms, he will be president and he will say, I'm different than Trump. Anyway, regarding socialism, if people are choosing socialism because of the failure of our phony, fake capitalism. We have a choice now between two parties. You want the bankruptcy on the left or the bankruptcy on the right. But neither is offering the solution. And that's what's missing from what I hear with so many conservatives talking about the appeal of socialism or lamenting the appeal of socialism correctly.
But how do you end up affording all of the promises that the DSA is making? They're promising something like $200 trillion in spending over the next 10 years. That's three times what the current federal budget is.
Yes, of course, I agree totally with that. You're absolutely right. As I say, the left is pushing bankruptcy, but what's missing is the conservatives are not owning up to our bankrupt, our phony capitalism,
Well, when you say phony capitalism, Tom, instead of just using that term, tell my audience what you mean by calling it phony capitalism. Tell me what that is.
Phony capitalism. The United States' primary description of government right now is fascism. It's where the corporations and the government merge together for their own mutual benefit to the detriment of the great masses of people. And so we don't have capitalism here in America. We have fascism. And fascism is not the answer to socialism. Socialism is not the answer to fascism. The right needs to own up.
So what is the solution in your mind, since you've got the opinion? What's the solution?
We need to abolish the Federal Reserve, the IRS, and go back to a national sales tax, but that is collected. Most taxes should be collected and spent by local government.
Interesting idea. Tom, thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show. And you crawled into your crawl space.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Do you know the state of Oregon is spending over $500,000 to build a single low-income apartment, not an apartment building, a single low-income apartment. But taxpayers are not allowed to see where all that money is going. What exactly are they hiding? I'll get into the details of that in just a moment. First, I'm glad to welcome you to the show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our poll on X. You'll find the X poll question every day at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. And Phil is on the line from Rogue River. Hey, Phil, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Lars. It's about the Jewish Coalition Convention with the VP.
Yeah, and the J.D. Vance is speaking to them tonight, but he's banned all press, including his traveling press and the local press, from covering the event.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if there might be like a major security issue, so that they're not letting too many unnecessary people in, and it's more of a security issue than letting the press in.
Well, here's the question I'd ask you. The event apparently includes an audience of 1,000 people from all over the country, and the press would probably number a few dozen. Do you really think the Secret Service said, we can allow the VP to speak in front of 1,000 people, but we can't allow him to speak in front of 1,000 people plus a couple of dozen press corps who've also been just as vetted as the people who are there to watch the event, the participants in the event? Would that make any sense to you?
Yeah, true enough. I just thought it was a bit concerning why they would just completely close out the whole press. And I don't know.
I think Ari's analysis of it is right, that what J.D. Vance is trying to do is he thinks that there's a segment of Americans who, if they see him speaking in front of that big logo, that somehow they're going to say, okay, that's a non-starter, because J.D. Vance is going to run for president. Now, whether I'm going to end up backing him or not is another question, because I'm waiting to see who gets into the race in the next couple of years, because I don't think we've yet seen. We have had Republican races in the last, three cycles where we've seen dozens of potentially great candidates up there. And I like that, because the Democrats are usually, they've got almost nobody who's capable of running for the office. You remember what happened when Joe Biden was pushed to the, pushed out the door? And I think they were right to push him out the door, but replacing him with Kamala Harris, who is a terrible candidate. The Democrats don't seem to have a very big bench full of people, and the Republicans do. I think when that's the case, I think it's better to just keep your powder dry and watch and see who we end up with.
Yeah, they have no one. Thank you.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. Imagine Gavin Newsom running for president of the United States. Imagine, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, running for president of the United States. Does anybody think that any of those are going to be good choices for the United States of America? Anyway, glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. So about that $500,000 apartment, the Oregon Capital Chronicle reports Oregon spending on low-income housing has exploded in the past 5 years. The state has given developers $1.4 billion, but the cost of developing each of the apartments has almost doubled to $540,000. That's for a single apartment unit. Dozens of projects are lined up for an additional $850 million in state funding. Federal tax credits, which the state oversees, will bring in even more money. So we're talking about gigantic sums of money, and yet the public is not allowed to see the details of how all that money gets spent, according to the Oregon Capital Chronicle. Oregon is one of the only states in the country with a carve-out in its public records law that prevents disclosing the financial details of subsidized housing. That thwarts researchers and journalists who've tried to examine the cost. And I've told you about this before. When the state of Oregon comes out and says, we're going to build low-income or low-cost housing, it is not low-cost at all. It is routinely twice as much money for the state to do what they call low-cost housing as it costs for the private sector to actually just build apartment units in the private sector. And we've been pointing that out for years on this program. The issue, they say, is especially pressing in the Northwest. Leaders have tied the lack of affordable housing to the region's dire homelessness crisis. I think that's a load of garbage. There is nobody out there in a tent on methamphetamine who's, you know, would be able to have an apartment if apartments were just $100 or $200 or even $300 a month less. No, they're in that tent because they are shoving their, you know, basically their entire future either up their nose or into their arm, or they're smoking it in the form of fentanyl or methamphetamine. Now, Margaret Van Vliet, who's the former director of Oregon State Housing Agency, told ProPublica that lawmakers should revisit that exemption. Despite all the state's spending on housing, Oregon's homeless population continues to grow. So you spend more money on housing. You say housing is the problem. That's why people are on the streets. As I said, I think that's a load of hogwash. But if that's the argument you're going to make, how is it that when you're spending a record amount of money to build so-called low-income housing. In California, so-called low-income housing is over $1 million per apartment unit, and much of that is driven by government rules and construction prices that are responding to minimums set by the state government. The Times, the LA Times, found that more than 12,000 low-income families could have received homes between 2011 and 2015 had costs been as low as they were somewhere else. But they're keeping it all a secret. So is there any good reason to have a public records law that says when the public money is spent to build all this housing, the public is not allowed to know where the money goes or how the money gets spent? If anybody thinks that makes sense, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Coming up in a moment, honor killings sound like something that happens halfway around the world, but it's happening right here in America, and we'll talk about it next. Then your phone calls and emails. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk at LarsLarson.com. That's talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, when you hear about honor killings, they sound like something that happens in a third world country somewhere other than the United States. But Liberty Counsel says they're actually happening right here in America and warns that problem could be growing. Thought we'd talk to John Amon, who's Vice President of Marketing at Liberty Counsel and author of Patriot's Handbook on Sharia's Threat to American Culture. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Lars. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you as well. Would you mind telling my audience, I think many of them could imagine they know what the generic definition of an honor killing is, but would you mind just refreshing their memory on what an honor killing is and how we came to start having them in the United States of America?
Well, an honor killing is an attempt to retrieve the lost honor of a family when primarily teen girls take actions that are offensive or dishonoring, they think, to the Islamic faith or to the family. For example, if a teen girl converts to Christianity, that dishonors the family. And so they'll take action either to hustle her out of the country or to take her life. More recently, just last year, as you probably know, up in Lacey, Washington, there was an instance where a father tried to publicly strangle his 17-year-old daughter outside the high school she attended. And he had to be pulled off, otherwise he almost certainly would have killed her. He was 44, big husky guy, trying to take the life of his own child in a public way. So enraged was he at the loss, he thought, of their honor as a family. So, and this kind of thing has been happening for years here in the United States. And it's, I hate to say it this way, but it's it's really a feature, not a bug, of Islam. And it's been imported to the United States by the Islamic faith.
I mean, it's something that Islam does not seem anxious to try to get rid of. I mean, if there were a practice by, say, Christian churches in America, or people who go to Christian churches, and it was something like this, where you were hurting members of your own family because you thought perhaps they'd done something that dishonored the family, I would expect that most Christian churches would tell their parishioners, you're not allowed to behave this way, and we're going to officially condemn it. But is the Islamic community doing that?
I haven't heard it. You know, you would expect that authoritative imams who preside at large mosques might speak out, or Islamic organizations here in the United States would issue public statements in direct opposition to this kind of thing. But I am not aware of it at all. And I think that that's unfortunately fairly telling about what the stance is of the nation. I mean, and of course, honor killings are not limited to the United States. They happen frequently across the Muslim world. So it is a just one aspect of Sharia law that makes life so horrible for so many people, I'm sad to say.
I'm talking to John Amon, who is Vice President of Marketing at Liberty Counsel. So is this the reason that Liberty Counsel has made the argument that Sharia law, which is a part of Islam, or a way that Islam is practiced in a number of countries, is incompatible with the U.S. Constitution?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is, because Sharia is the, quote, Islamic way of doing things. It's a complex and detailed and totalitarian system that requires to be that has to be superior. It is it's incompatible for that reason with the U.S. Constitution, because by nature Sharia law governs every aspect, public and private, of an individual and a culture's life. So it can't have competitors. And in the initial stages, when Islam is few in number or has a small population, it's in no position to assert that kind of a thing. But it is being infiltrated in various ways here in the United States. Even in Texas, there was a Islamic tribunal that advertised its services online, and that has been fought and is being shut down by the state of Texas, but they actually went public online offering their services from their judges, who were defined as judges. They said that disputes would be resolved according to Islamic jurisprudence and its Sharia or law. Its purpose was to settle any dispute among Muslims really residing in the U.S. So that's just one example of how Sharia is.
Well, is that constitutional to offer that kind of public service, to say, we're going to resolve this instead of having the American courts resolve it, we'll resolve it by Sharia law?
No, it's not. And for that reason, when Texas caught wind of it, the governor and the attorney general, Ken Paxton, took quick action to enforce the primacy of Texas law first, and then, of course, federal law when it came to all sorts of matters, including divorce and other marital disputes. But it's outside of the Supreme Court. The U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the United States, and so any competitor has no standing here in the U.S.
Well, John, you know what this reminds me of? I'm a Protestant Christian. I'm not LDS. But there are LDS people out there, and there was a point where the LDS Church had a dispute with the United States government because they practiced polygamy at the time. And in the end, the resolution of that eventually was that the LDS Church had to officially disclaim, you know, polygamous arrangement. Now, are there other spinoffs from the main Mormon church who still practice polygamy? Yes, there are. But the main church has said, no, we're not going to do that. Islam could do the same thing in the United States if it chose to do so, couldn't it?
Oh yeah, it could, but it in a sense it can't, because that would be to abrogate the very character of Islam. And you know, honor killings are not the only element of Sharia law that are completely foreign to the United States that we need to address. I mean, slavery is a part of Sharia law. Child bride marriages, which do occur here in the United States, are endorsed in Sharia. Capital punishment for leaving Islam or for
being
offending
an apostate.
Being an apostate. Yep. All that, criticizing Muhammad. All these things are actual capital crimes. Now, that's not taking place in the United States, so far as I know, but that's Sharia law. So it's not just honor killings, horrific as they are. There's a whole host of things that come with the entire package.
I don't doubt that. John, thank you very much. That's John Amon, who is Vice President of Marketing at Liberty Counsel and author of Patriot's Handbook on Sharia's Threat to American Culture. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. An automotive shop.
Missed the Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's a pleasure to be with you. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers right to the head of the line. Always have for 30 years, always will. And you can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I try to read every one of them. I try to respond to every one of them. And our poll on X today, are delivery and service people today in retail getting too pushy about tips? For example, the delivery fee is already $6 on a $20 pizza, and then the delivery person gets mad that they're only getting a $4 tip. In other words, they're getting a tip that's two-thirds of the delivery cost again, or 20% on top of the cost of the food. Are the delivery and service people getting too pushy about the tips? I'd have to agree with that and say yes, they are. To your calls now. Let me start with naysayer Bert, who's listening in Bellingham on KGMI. Hey, Bert, welcome to the program. What's on your mind, and what do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Hey, Lars, so before I start, I don't agree with my argument, okay? But it is the way it is.
That's an interesting way to start, but go ahead.
Yeah, the argument is about the Sharia law and about how that should be not applied in the United States. And I would counter that with it's the equivalent of arbitration being forced on parties, even though they have no choice in it, like unions or anything else where there's an arbitration clause being forced on people. And also in bureaucracy, in where we are being fined, jailed, imprisoned, property seized away from us, not because of any law that Congress has passed, although God knows what happens in Washington State with a completely de-legislature and all the way up to the Supreme Court where they just rule however they want. They don't even do that. It's just the bureaucrats going out and making up rules and then enforcing them. I mean, you got people out there.
Except
that,
for one
that,
thing,
that,
the only time I've ever had to go through an arbitration, Bert, it was because both parties had agreed to the arbitration to begin with. Real estate is like that, where if you, in most real estate transactions, both parties, when you bought the house, have to agree. If you ever have a dispute, you have to go through arbitration. But in that case, both parties have agreed ahead of time, if we have a dispute, we'll settle it through arbitration. Is that the case with the Sharia law? Or is this more likely that, let's say, the husband has a dispute with the wife, that when he says, I'm going to resolve this through a Sharia court, she doesn't have much choice or much say in it, which is not constitutional, is it?
Well, and that's the same, my same point about the arbitration. When I was working for a company and they sold the company, and a union came in with the new buyer.
Yeah,
they forced arbitration on us. Okay, I didn't have a choice. I mean, that was
the contract that they signed on your behalf, right?
Correct.
But hold on. When you decided to join the union, you were agreeing that the union would represent you. When they represented you and said, yeah, we're going to sign a contract that includes arbitration, they were doing so as your representative, weren't they?
Yes.
I mean, if you hired me and said, Lars, go down and buy me a pickup truck and get me the best deal you can get. So I go down and I agree to spend, these days you can spend $100,000 on a brand new four-wheel drive, all the bells and whistles pickup truck. And I come back to you and I say, yeah, it's going to cost you about $100,000. And you say, well, hold on, Lars, I didn't agree to that. And I say, well, you made me your representative and told me to go buy the truck. I went and bought it. And now you have to pay the bill because you agreed to make me your representative, right?
Right, but in the same way, when someone agrees to enter into a contractual marriage with someone who believes in Sharia law, you're accepting that that's what's going to happen.
I don't think so. In the United States of America.
When I was working for a company for 16 years, the new employer comes in and he forces unionship on me. I have a choice. I can either go hungry because there's no other jobs in my skill trade within 300 miles that's not represented by a union,
right,
or
right.
I can join the union. That's a forced arbitration.
It is forced because the people of that state have chosen not to make it a right-to-work state, which would forbid that kind of it. But now we're mixing two things up. You say when somebody gets married, if somebody gets married in the United States and then they say, I'm going to get divorced, they can go to another state and get divorced under that state's rules. There are some consequences to that. But you're allowed to get divorced whatever way you want, but it's generally through the government. But if you go to a Sharia court and you say, if you're the one who seeks it out, on the other hand, should the woman who's married to a man and the man goes to a Sharia court and the Sharia court says, the woman is wrong, you're right, and we're going to grant you a divorce and grants that, in a way that doesn't allow the woman any appeals at all. Appeals are part of why we value our God-given constitutional rights in this country. Because if you're convicted of a crime, you can appeal. If you lose a civil lawsuit, you can appeal. But under Sharia law, I have a feeling a woman trying to appeal against a man, good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Just saying.
And this is why I said I don't agree with my argument. Because I agree Sharia law should not be here. I also agree that arbitration freely entered into by both parties,
yes,
should be allowed, but not if one party's being coerced or forced into it through whatever means necessary. Same thing as a bureaucrat comes a 501c3 nonprofit do-gooder comes on my property and says, oh, that ditch there in front of your property, it's got water in it 2 months out of the year. So that's a salmon stream. So now you have a 250-foot setback on both sides of it.
What happened when they threw out the Chevron doctrine.
They said that it's a salmon stream, so they write it down in the maps from the county maps and says, oh, it's a salmon stream now.
Well, guess what? We finally got a good resolution of that one, didn't we? Because it was Obama that was pushing that waters of the United States nonsense, that if you got a damp spot on a piece of land somehow, that the EPA's in charge. And now the U.S. Supreme Court has thrown out the Chevron doctrine and is now the Loper-Bright doctrine. And instead, we're not assuming that the bureaucrats are always right. But naysayer Bert, very good naysayer, and I always appreciate that. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. Send emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. You can vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day. You'll find it at Lars Larsen Show. Are the delivery and service folks getting just a bit too pushy when it comes to the tips? You're listening to the Lars Larsen Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larsen Show. FM News 101.